It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Outside groups have spent more than $8.9 million on Wisconsin's state legislative races. That's as of October 8th, according to the nonpartisan Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. There's still a few weeks to go before Election Day.
Outside spending refers to groups that have no affiliation with candidates trying to influence elections.
Some outside groups are able to skirt federal campaign finance laws, like disclosing donors or adhering to contribution limits. And outside spending in Wisconsin and around the country has skyrocketed in the last couple decades because of a series of Supreme Court decisions.
Here to explain more is Nick Ramos, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. That's a watchdog group that tracks campaign finance. Nick, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Good morning to you. Hey. Thank you guys so much for having me on, man. I'm not a morning person, but man,
you sound like it. You sound like it. But you also have brought us, from what I understand, updated numbers on outside spending. What are you finding?
Well, here's the funny thing. This number changes every day. So, the minute we publish an article, it's only good for that day. And then the next day, we got to be trying to keep up with the record money that's being spent. So as of last night, over $10.9 million instead of that 8.9, it's jumped $2 million in about a week. So as far as just independent expenditures in the legislative election, so we continue to just whip and glide all the way to November 5th. And if you think we are stopping here, you have not seen anything yet. We've got a lot more money that's going to come into this state. And as you guys correctly said, it has everything to do with some of these federal cases. But also, we have to look inward at the state bills and laws that we have on the books that make it the Wild West here.
Well, first of all, can you put the $10.9 million in context for us? How does it compare from previous elections? Trace it for us a little bit, where it's going?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me trace it and then we'll work backwards because let me tell you something. Let me tell you about where we've been. In 2020, all right, just for the year, we had $8.84 million that was spent by independent expenditures. So the fact is that us sitting here October 17th, and it's already at $10.9 million, when the entire year in 2020, it was sitting at only about eight, didn't even break $9 million.
Mm-hmm.
It should tell people that we are on a just hyper-speed chase towards November 5th. And then when I think about just the money in and of itself, look at some of these Senate district races that, are right now in play because of the new maps that we have, and they're right now reporting some of the highest spending that's going on. For instance, in the 30th Senate District, we're there at $2.06 million, and, that's an open seat between, Democrat Jamie Wall and Republican Jim Rafter. Previously there was an incumbent there, but he got Drew out of the district, so people are looking at that map and looking at that district. They're like, well, it's an open seat. It's a new opportunity. We're going to flood money into it. And then I know people have seen a lot about the 8th Senate District, where currently it's technically open, but right now it's between Republican Dewey Strobel, mm-hmm. and he represents the 20th. And then you have Democrat Jody Habish-Sinken. She ran for that seat and in the past, and now there's about $1.46 million on the IEs and the independent expenditures. And so it just shows you that with new maps, there's so much competition to try and be able to secure these seats because there's been opportunities that have never been on the table before. And people are really showing that by how they're spending money and how they're moving it around. And I think it is going to, by the time we get to November 5th, I would love to come back here and talk about the numbers because I'm sure it'll be nauseating.
Nick, can you talk about what are the biggest outside spenders this season? Can you talk more about the PACs that you're seeing and how they're spending their money?
Absolutely. So I would say as of right now, these orgs and these PACs, they can end up shifting the way that the money is moving. But so far, I'd say some of the big ones that we've seen, I mean, Wisconsin Initiative, they're sitting at $1.94 million. A Better Wisconsin Together political fund, they're around $1.51 million. The Restoration PAC, $1.24 million. These are all in the millions. Wisconsin Conservation Voters, Independent Expenditure Committee, I mean, and then you see, like, the Republican State Leadership Committee and some of these Jobs First Coalition political funds, they're edging around $700,000 to $800,000. But I think by the time we hit November 5th, we're going to be looking at these political funds and these PACs starting to really increase and ramp it up, especially when we're less than a week from in-person early voting. And a lot of the money, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I thought I was safe from seeing ads on streaming, but apparently, you know, a lot of these folks are very privy to the fact that, you know, a lot of people have cut cable, and so you're seeing ads not only there, but you're seeing ads ran across social media platforms. I'm sure people's phones have been blowing up via text message. I mean, as far as how the money is being moved, I mean, they're doing it through a variety of different persuasion methods, and they're trying to really get people not only thinking about these races, but we also have a constitutional amendment on the ballot that I feel like a lot of people have not spent nearly enough time talking about, but there is definitely vested interest, and you're seeing a lot of these groups out of the woodworks with vested interest, not only in that, but trying to see their candidates get across the finish line, and they're using their money to do the talking because they're flooding these districts, and then they're using these PACs to try and then take the money and move it where they think they have a winnable seat. And because of the way that the laws are, I mean, it really has created a scenario where the money continues to pile up and there's no way to put our arms around it because of the laws we have on the books.
We're talking about the record-breaking outside spending in Wisconsin legislative races. We have Nick Ramos with us, executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, which has been tracking outside spending in the state. Nick, in 2015, Wisconsin Republican lawmakers overhaul our state's fundraising laws, allowing unlimited donations to Wisconsin's political parties. What effect are those campaign finance laws having today?
It's the thing that gives me heartburn every day, because honestly, if we look back, and I even go a little bit before that, like you see in 2010, Citizens United, where, you know, I guess corporations, according to the Supreme Court, get this right to then be able to chime in on our elections and spend money on candidates and on political platforms. And then fast forward that about 4 years later, McCutcheon v. FEC, where, you know, you had an individual step up and say, hey, I see there's a limit on how much money I can spend overall during a federal election, and I think that's a violation of my free speech. And therefore, like, I think it's unconstitutional. And a 5-4 split, Supreme Court agreed with that individual. And now, like, it created a scenario where they took off the ceiling of the aggregate limit where, you know, an individual can donate directly to a political candidate. And then a year later, 2015, you look at during the Walker administration, the campaign finance rewrite we have been living under, I mean, they essentially took off the ceiling when it comes to our laws. I mean, think about the fact that when it comes to gubernatorial races and state Supreme Court races, originally a direct max out from an individual contributor would be $10,000. They doubled that to 20 grand, which is absurd if you think about what the max out is for a presidential candidate, which is, I believe, $3,300. Mm-hmm. And so can anyone realistically say that the governor here, and I love, you know, being able to talk about state politics, but can anybody say that the governor or the state Supreme Court is six times more important than the president? I don't think so. And then you have alluded to the fact that not only is that, I think, troubling, but then you think about the unlimited transfers between the political parties and the campaigns and also the committees. So, for instance, if you max out to your candidate of choice, well, hey, that's okay. You can literally send as much money as you want to the political party and or the committee, and guess what? They can send unlimited money to the candidate. And they are so brazen about it nowadays. Like, they know the system. And they're like, guess what? It created this whole legal money laundering system where you can do unlimited transfers. Go on.
Nick, I want to just turn our attention for a moment, because you've been getting to these Get Out the Vote events. And I'm just wondering if all of the ads and the different approaches these campaigns are taking to get in front of voters, what have you been hearing out there from people?
I mean, people are exhausted. I mean, people on the ground, and I get the luxury of traveling the state, people constantly say the money in politics, it affects every level of government, from local to federal. And people want to see change, but it's one of those issues that it's hard to be able to give folks a tangible thing that they can do a call to action for. It's easy to rally people and explain to people an injustice and then have something that they can go do to try and change the problem. But when you show these numbers that we've been talking about this whole time, I mean, I don't know about you, but it makes me weak in the knees. Like, this is like colossal money. And so it's like, how is little old me supposed to do something about this? But seriously, getting out to vote, especially when we have these new legislative maps, is the key. Because we're going to have real opportunities after November to actually leverage and pressure this new legislature into taking campaign finance reform seriously. And we can actually start to mobilize people and bring this to their steps and force them to not only reform our system, but bring back things that were popular, like public campaign finance system, to take the incentive off of all this private and dark and all this money and making it easier for the little guy.
Nick, thank you for the update. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Nick Ramos is executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. That's a watchdog group focused on campaign finance. And we were talking about how his organization is tracking outside spending during this election cycle.
Just ahead on Wisconsin Today, a La Crosse doctor shares how she guides her patients through the pain of inserting an IUD after the federal government advises doctors to address pain management.
Hopefully this guidance will help more clinicians really think about pain as a serious complication and part of the process.
IUDs and reproductive health in Wisconsin, that's coming up next.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Verrett. When Republican Congressman Derek Van Orden won his Western Wisconsin district, he presented himself as a political outsider.
Now he's spent 2 years in Congress, and Van Orden's firebrand approach has featured prominently in his race against Democratic challenger Rebecca Cook. Hope Kerwin reports on the race for Wisconsin's 3rd congressional district, one of the most competitive in the state.
While he's now an incumbent, Derek Van Orden's political outsider brand remains central to his campaign. In one of his TV ads, Van Orden compares his colleagues in Washington to a herd of unruly goats.
You got a bunch of loudmouth, preening politicians. It's absolute chaos.
The Republican from Prairie du Chien frequently talks about his humble beginnings, raised by a single mother, and his 26 years in the military. He says he hopes to return to Congress in order to lower consumer prices, improve public safety, and tighten border security. Here he is talking to supporters at a Trump campaign rally in Eau Claire.
This election is about 3 things. It's gas, groceries, and grandkids.
Political science professor Anthony Chergosky from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse says it's not surprising to see Van Orden try to hang on to his political outsider image. Chergosky says voters frequently believe someone from outside of Washington politics will have a better understanding of what communities need. And the label explains a lot about the 3rd Congressional District's voting history.
What can explain an area that votes strongly for Obama twice and then goes the other way, going for Trump twice? And the best I can do is to say that this area responds to the outsider.
Van Orden has been a longtime supporter of former President Donald Trump. He also shares Trump's reputation as a political firebrand. Van Orden made national news when he heckled President Joe Biden during his State of the Union speech this year, and when he traded insults with Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz. He received the most backlash when he cursed at a group of U.S. Senate pages last year. The teenagers were lying on the floor of the U.S. Capitol's rotunda to take pictures of the famous dome. The congressman accused the teens of treating the Capitol like, quote, a frat house common room. Democrat Rebecca Cook from Eau Claire has tried to seize on this behavior as evidence that Van Orden does not represent the district's moderate stance.
That, to me, is not the decorum that we want to see from a member of Congress. So I think, in my perspective, I think he thinks he's better than us.
Cook is a former political fundraiser and is now a business owner in her hometown. She says she's running to represent the working class in Washington by lowering health care costs and supporting farms like the one she grew up on. Cook has tried to argue that Van Orden is an advocate of radical policies, but some organizations that track congressional votes have a different take. The political website 538 says the congressman has the most moderate voting record out of all of Wisconsin's Republicans in Congress. The 3rd District is arguably the most divided in Wisconsin, and voters there are split on whether they like Van Orden's approach. While recently enjoying Riverside Park in downtown La Crosse, Paul Krause says he likes that Van Orden isn't afraid to critique people on both sides of the aisle. He thinks Van Orden's less polished tone is a product of his military career.
I think often he's just very honest and forthright in terms of what he has to say. May rub people the wrong way, but you know, that's kind of up to where you're at.
Sarah Papian lives near Richland Center and stopped by the Viroqua Farmers Market earlier this month. She described Van Orden as abrasive and said his aggressive tone is at odds with how people in the district behave.
I may not agree with all of Rebecca Cook stuff either, but she does seem to be, like I said, that approachable, able to talk to, able to listen to without being talked down to.
Trigoski says it's hard to say who voters will ultimately see as the outsider candidate and whether the title really matters in an increasingly partisan political climate. Given the district's support of Trump in the last 2 presidential elections, he says Cook's campaign knows she'll need to win over at least a few swing voters in order to flip the seat. Hope Kerwin, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is Wisconsin Today.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention released updated guidance this year on how doctors insert intrauterine devices known as IUDs. The focus is on better pain management and preparing the patient for how they might experience that procedure.
WPR's Wisconsin Project gathered stories from patients about the pain they experienced when getting an IUD. Melissa Klassen of Superior was excited to get her IUD a few years ago, and she told her medical provider she could handle painful things.
I've had kidney stones before. Some people describe kidney stones as the worst pain of your life. I have a lot of tattoos. I have a lot of piercings. I said, I can do this. I'm going to be okay. It's going to be fine. And I can confidently say it was the worst pain I've ever experienced.
Melissa's story is just one example of the nearly 20 people who reached out and shared their experiences with WPR.
We now turn to a physician on how to manage the pain of IUDs. Dr. Kara Petrashek is an obstetrician gynecologist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. Dr. Petrashek, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
Patients can have a range of experiences with an IUD procedure. What might it be like for your patients when it's most tolerable and then when it's least tolerable?
So for patients in the office, some come in and are very prepared, or maybe they're even having their 2nd or 3rd IUD placed. They know what to expect. And they talk to me through the entire procedure. And at the end, they say, "Oh gosh, are you already done?" And they walk out with a smile on their face. And I think that's the best case scenario. And then there at the other end of the spectrum, there are patients who are very nervous, have maybe never had a sensitive exam done, period, and they are in a lot of discomfort. We need to give them extra time and extra kind of TLC in the office before they even leave because of inner anxiety.
When you talk about time, it's a procedure that might only take a few minutes. Is that right?
Exactly. Usually for me to place an IUD, the actual placement of it itself is 2 minutes or less, the vast majority of the time.
Do physicians know why some patients experience more pain than others?
We can have some ideas. And so a big part of it is whether you've had a pregnancy before and a delivery. And so we know if that cervix has been opened up in that way, it probably is just used to that stretch, which is the same kind of stretch that we need to place the IUD itself. And so most women who have had, especially a vaginal delivery, have less pain and tolerate the IUD placement better. For younger patients, whether it's their age, maybe combined with the fact that they haven't had that delivery experience before, they have more pain. Another is anxiety, underlying anxiety, depression. If people have had a traumatic sexual experience or abuse before. And then their feelings about the IUD placement. We know that people who think it's going to be painful have more pain.
Oh, what does this new CDC guidance say about how doctors should approach IUD procedures with their patients?
The guidance is really telling us to acknowledge pain in a more thoughtful way. And I think all of us clinicians that place IUD have hoped that we've done this, but being even more intentional about discussing, okay, what could this be like? Acknowledging that there is a large variation in what the patient sitting in front of you might feel, trying to glean a little bit more about their expectations and their desires for this experience, and then offering them some of the pain control options that we have available.
Will your clinical approach change at all with the CDC guidance?
I do think that I am even more thoughtful since it has come out about discussing people's options. And part of that is because of the social media campaign that honestly really led to these guidelines. Women are coming in with not only more information, but honestly, sometimes it's more of a negative bias. They're more nervous. They're more anxious about the experience because of what they've seen. And so I want to make sure that they have their options known to them and that they are a participant in deciding what is the best route for pain control for them during this procedure.
And we're going to hear now from one of the patient voices. Ariana Hones told us how she felt after her first attempt to get an IUD in Wisconsin when she was a college student years ago.
I just left that first attempt feeling really like embarrassed and kind of ashamed, like, oh, I couldn't like handle it, and really uncomfortable about just the whole process. And feeling like, that I'd somehow like failed to do it versus, were there other options? And that didn't feel like it was ever really a conversation.
Why is it important for patients to be more informed and more prepared for the pain that might come with the procedure?
Because we don't want people to feel like that. Certainly, I never want a person to feel that they are embarrassed or that they failed when they leave my office, because I don't think that of any of my patients. And also, an IUD is a really great option for multiple reasons, whether it's an excellent contraceptive to prevent pregnancy. It can be really great for abnormal uterine bleeding, for some of the endometriosis or pelvic pain conditions that we have for women. So I want them to make sure that they know that it is not only an available option, but one that's not going to be miserable for them to experience.
The medical profession, though, has this history of underestimating and dismissing and minimizing women's pain. How do you think that history factors into what is happening with IUDs, what's unfolding on social media, and this new guidance from the CDC?
I think it absolutely has a huge historical perspective when we think about women's pain through the years, whether it's monthly menstrual cycles to childbirth to IUD placement and beyond. It is our job as the new generation of clinicians to both acknowledge and discuss and make sure that we are also believing our patients when they tell us that they're uncomfortable or embarrassed or in pain, and stopping and saying, okay, what needs to change?
We're talking with OBGYN Dr. Kara Petrochik of Gundersen Health System, talking about the updated CDC guidelines for inserting IUDs, part of the reproductive health care system. Dr. Petrochik, why do patients opt for IUDs as a form of contraception? How would you place it overall in reproductive health care?
The IUD is over 99% effective for preventing pregnancy, and that's its number one use. And it is part of the group of contraceptives that we call LARCs, long-acting reversible contraceptives. So I, you know, kind of joke with my patients, you can set it and forget it. We have IUDs that are good for between 5 and 10 years, depending on the type. And so once it's placed, you can feel confident in your prevention of pregnancy. But more than that, it can be used to significantly decrease the amount and the pain of monthly periods. And then we're also using it to decrease the risk of uterine cancer or to treat some uterine precancers.
The first IUD available in the U.S. was 1964. So for 60 years, these devices have been planted in women in this country. Is the medical community still learning about the full ramifications of IUDs? Is it evolving?
I think that when our newer generations of IUDs came out, so the Paragard copper IUD came out in the 80s and is still in use today, and then the progesterone-based IUDs, the Mirena, the Lyletta, Skyla, Kylena, that came out in the early 2000s, are so much better than the IUDs of, like you said, the 60s and the 70s. And so there was this huge learning curve now, and now we've got this these really great devices. Maybe there will be more to come in the future, but I am really happy with the options that we have currently for women in the IUD world.
Do you think, are there patients who are avoiding IUDs out of fear of pain, out of fear of what they've learned from other women?
Yes, absolutely. I feel like definitely on a daily, maybe daily basis, I'm trying to encourage women about some of the myths that they've heard about IUD insertion or complications and trying to review of what a safe and effective option they are.
It makes me wonder, though, because counseling about pain management, I mean, that's standard practice in any medical procedure. And has there been a disconnect between patients about this aspect of the medical procedure in IUD placement?
I think one thing that may be helpful to think about is that when IUDs first came out, and even in the early 2000s, they were really marketed towards women who had already had children.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of talked a little bit before about how those women tend to have less pain and an easier IUD insertion overall. And then in the last 10 plus years, they've really been more available to people who have never had a pregnancy, adolescents, just younger women in general, and they tend to have more pain. So I think it was this great expansion of the use of the IUD, but we were still putting it in and talking to women the same way that we did in the early 2000s, and that should have shifted as well.
Hmm. Going forward, do you see a growing use of IUDs in reproductive health care? What does the future hold for the IUD?
Yeah, about 15% of women are currently choosing an IUD as their form of contraceptive, and it keeps becoming more popular, and it's so well tolerated. And like I said, you can kind of that set it and forget it mentality. So I think we'll keep seeing it expand, but we are also seeing other great options for the contraception and abnormal bleeding. And so there's new pills that are coming out. There's patches, there's rings, there's injections. So the field keeps expanding and keeps offering women new options because each person is individual and there is no one thing that works for everybody.
In terms of the procedure itself, some doctors like yourself recommend patients take an over-the-counter pain reliever. How effective is that for reducing some of the discomfort involved?
Well, it's interesting because in studies, taking ibuprofen, which is what my office usually recommends, an hour beforehand does not improve the insertional pain. What we're more trying to do is help with that after insertion crampiness that I had alluded to before. There is one medication, naproxen, that in some studies has been shown to decrease the insertional pain, but traditional over-the-counters are not that helpful with that immediate discomfort.
Dr. Petrochek, as we go forward here in our final moments together, what impact do you think this new CDC guidance will have on the medical community and ultimately on the patients who are receiving IUDs?
I think a lot of patients know the benefit of the IUD and the reason that they want it, and there's a barrier to having it placed. So hopefully this guidance will help break down that barrier and help more clinicians really think about pain as a serious complication and part of the process and discuss it with patients and allow patients to determine what pain control option they want.
Dr. Petrochek, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That is Dr. Kara Petrochek, an obstetrician-gynecologist at Gunderson Health System in La Crosse. She was with us to discuss new guidelines from the CDC on pain management for the insertion of IUDs. You can read more about the experience of Wisconsin patients from our digital producer, Jonah Balekas, in his story that is on WPR.org.
Coming up, a new city planning project at UW-Milwaukee tackles modern-day segregation.
And we as planners, historically, you know, have contributed in some ways to these problems by failing to consider all of the practices and policies that have segregated America.
That's up next here on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Milwaukee is known as one of the most segregated cities in America, but a new UW-Milwaukee Center is hoping to change that and help the city and state thrive with new strategies in municipal planning.
The Center for Equity Practice and Planning Justice aims to help solve racial segregation problems with zoning reform and innovative development.
Kirk Harris is the center's inaugural director, a certified planner, and an associate professor at UW-Milwaukee in the Department of Urban Planning. Kirk, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you having me.
Well, before we dig into the issue, can you talk us through the main goals of this new Center for Equity, Practice, and Planning Justice?
Absolutely. So in 1954, Brown v. Board of Education outlawed segregation in America. And the challenge that we have today is that we're as segregated now as we were in 1954, if not more so. We know that there are a number of reasons for that. One is that we've had housing policies that have contributed to the inequalities associated with opportunities related to housing. We've had infrastructure development and urban renewal, which has deconstructed communities and displaced communities in ways that have heightened segregation. We have economic development practices that exacerbate the problem. And then we have zoning, which continues to manifest inequalities as a result of the inability to create diverse housing and also affordable housing. So all of these things in combination have magnified the problems. And we as planners historically have, you know, have contributed in some ways to these problems by failing to consider all of the practices and policies that have segregated America, and we have woefully short strategies for addressing the problems. So we find ourselves in a reality in which segregation is the the order of the day, if you will, in our urban settings.
And that's a point I want to stick with a little bit. I think if you grow up in a city or visit a city, you just think, well, that's where the road is, and that's the black neighborhood, and that's the white neighborhood, and it just sort of happened that way. Can you talk about how planning decisions, conscious decisions in many cases, led to some of the biggest segregation problems we have now?
First of all, let me just say, zoning as a part of the planning practice has been historically the fundamental thing that has contributed to the problem, along with the fact that we created a housing policy strategy that has suburbanized America in ways that actually allowed the out-migration of the white population from cities and have kind of trapped, if you will, communities of colors inside the cities. And at the same time, those resources that are necessary to contribute to the well-being and sustainability of the cities were drained as populations of the white community moved out. We as planners in some ways contributed to that because historically we have not necessarily challenged, and I don't think that's true today, but I think historically we did not necessarily challenge these racially motivated practices which essentially intentionally segregated communities. Today, we're a lot better as a practice, and we know that there are a number of things that we have to work on in order to ensure that this doesn't continue. So, for example, the city of Milwaukee has been visiting this idea of growing Milwaukee, and the idea is to advance zoning practice in ways that contribute to more affordable housing, diverse sets of housing, and which creates an opportunity for inclusive housing. I think that's an important first step. It's a necessary step, but it's not a sufficient step in ensuring we can address these longstanding problems. The truth is that if we look at the ways in which our lending practices are taking place in our cities, even today, in terms of how that is manifesting, we still see inequities emerging from these things. So we're working against the tide of practices and regulatory schemes that have historically kind of reinforced segregation.
Now, a key word in the name of this new agency is practice. What are you going to do to make sure that this isn't, you know, an academic thing for academics, something that is actually working with city planners and making things change in the real world?
Well, first of all, you have to have a diverse set of stakeholders at the table. You have to have the city, the regional planning agency. You have to have local organizations. You have to have organizations that are, in fact, working on health issues. You have to have organizations that are working on education issues, because any issue that you find where there's growing inequality in cities all stem back to segregation. And it touches everything. It touches everything from economic development and our environment, or housing, education. It touches health. It just touches everything, which means that we have to have a set of committed stakeholders and strategic partners. And over the last year, I have actually been able to assemble a really impressive group of strategic stakeholders. And and what's interesting about that assemblage is that when I present this idea to the folks that I've been talking to, there is a level of commitment and excitement about addressing this. And you mentioned practice. So yes, we are sitting in an academic institution, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. But, you know, we already know a lot about why we're segregated. We don't need to know any more about why we're segregated. But what we're woefully short on is the practices that will lead us down the road that will address this problem. And so I have three kind of areas of work that I think is going to be really important for doing that. First, innovative planning practices. We have to examine the ways in which we've engaged in community economic development, the ways in which we've invested in communities, the ways in which we incentivize certain activities in cities to ensure that we're not replicating the very problems that are built into this highly segregated society. Secondly, we have to look at the regulatory schemes, zoning, and other issues that have historically lent themselves to the problem and recognize that they're integrated with, issues around market forces that have contributed to the high high levels of segregation in cities. And so we have to recognize that while we're working on zoning issues, we also have to work on how do we create more affordable housing? What are some additional partners outside of the traditional market that we can leverage for purposes of doing something different in terms of housing? There's lots of innovative strategies, for example, that are emerging around land trust, and which is a strategy for communities taking control over their land in ways that don't allow them to it be a part of the speculation that leads to displacement, and which has historically been a challenge in many communities. You know, gentrification is a big issue. And then finally, looking at the narrative that we have around inclusive communities, we have curated in our society an understanding that diverse communities are not communities that lend themselves to increased property values and, in fact, lend themselves to decline and problems. And I think we have to change that narrative. I think we've curated it in our society as a function of law, practice, and policy. And now we have to create new opportunities for having different kinds of conversations about what does it mean to have an inclusive community. And what do inclusive communities look like? And what do they contribute to the overall sustainability and fabric of our society? And so those are the kind of broadly the three areas that I think that the center is going to work on. And from my perspective, practice is at the heart of it, meaning it's not about just what we know, it's about what we do.
We're talking to Kirk Harris, inaugural director of the new Center for Equity, Practice, and Planning Justice at UW-Milwaukee. Kirk, the physical layout of cities. So many cities, Milwaukee included, have histories where a new highway, say, or other infrastructure project was run right through what had been a thriving, in many cases, Black neighborhood, or creating physical barriers between Black and white neighborhoods. To solve some of these problems we're talking about, do we need to change some of the physical layout, the infrastructure of a city?
First of all, let me just kind of reflect a little bit about on that history. That history was driven by urban renewal. And urban renewal was fueled by what was happening in the cities where white communities were fleeing the city. We were losing investment in the city. We were seeing decline as a result of that lost investment. And then we saw our cities, particularly around our urban core, in disarray, largely because of the lack of resources and investment. So the urban renewal sought to solve a problem that it created. And so the highways were just a mechanism for continuing that because they facilitated the in and out migrations of those communities from the suburban fringe into the cities. By the way, economists call that a free rider problem. That is, you use the infrastructure of the city, you move in and out of on that infrastructure, but all your tax dollars go somewhere else. And so these are the kinds of tensions that exist and that are manifest in kind of what we call structural racism, because what they do is they create this racial hierarchy that benefits one group over another. And infrastructure has historically, highways in particular, infrastructure has been historically a mechanism by which not only do we create these separations, we actually destroy communities as a function of the desire to intensify the segregation. And so this is really a problematic history, and we're living with it now because many of those highways still exist in communities which are creating that separation, and they create boundaries which to this day mitigate the opportunities for certain communities to benefit from the amenities and other attributes of the city.
I understand, Kirk, there's a lack of diversity historically in the planning profession. Is that part of your mission at the new center?
Absolutely. In fact, I've been teaching planning for over 20 years, and what I've seen over the course of my years is that we've done better in moving communities of color into planning, but there is just much, much, much more work to do. It's interesting because even as my students who are not necessarily people of color, they themselves recognize and have critiqued the fact that the planning profession needs to do better in that regard. And that's promising because if they themselves are doing that, then they can become advocates for that in the practice as they move into it. And, you know, we need to increase the pipeline of students of color into the planning world. And one way that the center wants to do that is look at ways in which we can get in contact and make contact with high school students who we might work with and say, hey, there's things happening in your community. What do you like about what's happening in your community? What don't you like about what's happening in your community? Would you like to work on a project that works on those things to improve outcomes in your community that you're concerned about? And so connecting to them and getting them to think about the communities in which they live and thinking about the ways in which they can influence outcomes in those communities becomes a very important part. And it creates a pipeline for those students into the university and into the planning profession.
And finally, Milwaukee, known as one of the most segregated metropolitan areas in the country, seems like a major task trying to tackle it. Does it ever feel too big to take on?
Let me just say, planners are optimists. we envision a future. And we envision a future in which we have sustainable, equitable, and vibrant cities. And so I never feel daunted by the fact that the problems are big. What I'm feeling encouraged by, particularly in Milwaukee, is the level of embracement and support and concern that I've gotten across a wide range of stakeholders. And with that kind of support, we can do all kinds of things. And the truth is that, you know, I grew up in the 60s and I witnessed the urban unrest in Newark, New Jersey. And one of the things that I recognized is that there's a legacy of work that has been done by folks who went before me. And I'm, as a lawyer and a planner, I'm mandated to keep that movement going. And one of the, you know, the legacy that I'm hoping that this center manifests is a legacy which really continues to challenge the orthodoxy which has historically been in place around our planning practices. And I'm never discouraged because, you know, one of my favorite Black intellectuals, Cornel West, says we have to find joy in the struggle because the struggle is all around us, and we recognize that the problem didn't occur overnight and it's not going to be solved overnight. But if we can get the committed people in the room having the right kinds of conversations, talking about the equitable outcomes and the democratic outcomes that we want to see in our society, anything's possible. And as much as Milwaukee is one of the most highly segregated cities in regions in the country, I can also say that over the course of this year, as I've been building toward this center, the level of accessibility and willingness of people to have conversations has been amazing. And so I'm tremendously hopeful, and the joy is in the struggle.
Kirk, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Kirk Harris is the director of the new Center for Equity Practice and Planning Justice at UW-Milwaukee. He's an associate professor there in the Department of Urban Planning.
There is a special day coming up. Wednesday is Public Radio Music Day, the fifth year celebrating the musical contributions of public radio stations all over the country.
Of course, here in Wisconsin, every day is Public Radio Music Day. On our other network, WPR Music, they're right over there. I'm pointing at the glass, and we're going to celebrate with them.
Yes, our own Stephanie Elkins on the other side of the glass will take us behind the scenes in the life of the music network. And I'm really hoping we can get her to share her personal early morning playlist that gets her ready for her on-air shift.
And you can join the festivities if you also listen to WPR Music or have some memories to share. Tell us about it. And if you have a get-up-and-go morning playlist with any kind of music, we'd love the suggestions.
Yes, email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us 888-642-0232 with your musical thoughts. And thanks so much.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at WPR.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to WPR News.